You are listening to a sermon by Charis Weathers, recorded on Sunday, May 13, 2018, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
This absolutely gorgeous Sunday. I am a little surprised how many people here and you're not outside, so this is awesome. I am a pastor within the Lutheran Church in the U.S., and we use the lectionary to give us some kind of direction for how we're going to preach. And so this John text comes from the lectionary. So this is the text that is being given in sermons in all kinds of churches across the globe today. So we get to hear this passage today. And there's a lot going on in it. You may want to keep it open on your lap, possibly, the John 17. And to give it a little bit of context, John 17 occurs on the night before Jesus is arrested. He and his disciples have had their Last Supper. There's the foot washing, but the soldiers haven't yet come to arrest him. So that's kind of the time period for this. And he's offering this really long prayer. He's in the midst of it in our section of text. And this prayer is offered on behalf of the disciples. And for the most part, it's a beautiful prayer. And wow, there's a lot to it. There's a lot to this prayer. And in reading some commentary, I was struck by how many different directions that folks have gone with this passage. Academics, bloggers, preachers, they've gone in a million different directions because there's a million different topics to talk about in this particular text. Writers have focused on the world. The world is written of a lot in here, and that's kind of the direction I thought I was going to go until I did a little bit more study. Unity is another topic that a lot of folks use in this text. Jesus' relationship with the disciples, and some people really think that this is a second version of the Lord's Prayer. There's so many things in here. So, but when I look at this text a little bit more as a whole with a larger theme, to me it reveals a stunning portrayal of our life with God. And I'll give you a warning that this is a little bit heady today. So I'm glad you have a little bit of time at the end for discussion. So if you have any questions, definitely save them up, and we'll talk through some stuff. But I'm going to try and break it down into some bite-sized pieces. So here's a roadmap of where we're going today. We're first going to look at some of the nature of Jesus' relationship with God, hence the icon, and what that means for us. And then we're going to look at the whole in and not in the world thing that's in this text. And then we're going to finish up with those last three verses about sanctification. So those are kind of the three things we're going to walk through a little bit today. In this passage, Jesus is praying for his disciples, and he talks a lot about giving. You see the word give a lot. Some form of the word give or given is used 9 times in these verses. God gave the disciples to Jesus, and everything that was given to Jesus by God has been given to the disciples by Jesus. Okay, so these first few verses have so much giving happening. Honestly, to me, when I was reading them, it sounded to me like the holy hand grenade of Antioch, which will delight Rosie. If you're familiar with that Monty Python movie, then thou shalt count to 3, no more, no less. There shall be the number thou shalt count, and the number of the counting shall be 3. And it sounds a lot like this to me. Give, you know, God gave this, Jesus gave that. And it's like the same thing being repeated. But it's just like, it is, the author of this text is really trying to just make it abundantly clear that what was given to Jesus was given by God, and Jesus is giving it back to the disciples. There's this handing forth that's happening in this text. Out of the giving of God to Jesus comes the giving to the disciples. And I think that most people who go through the seminary, Regent College, that Rosie and I went to are familiar with the word perichoresis. Anyone in here heard that word before, perichoresis? Okay. So it's a big Latin word, perichoresis. Big Latin word. It got its start in the 4th century as a way to describe the nature of the Trinitarian God. That's a hard type of thing to be able to describe. It's describing God as three persons, yet also one. And I've often heard this term, perichoresis, described as God in a dance. So all three members of the Trinity, God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit, are all in this dance, and they are weaving in and out of each other. There's no hierarchy, there's no lead, there's just enjoyment of the relationship in this dance of the universe, essentially. And Gregory of Nyssa was one of the early developers of this theology, and he said that each person of the Trinity was mutually permeating each other, so literally flowing in and out. So there's not only this divine dance, but unlike our human limitations of dance, they can literally move through and permeate each other's existence. Okay, so the Spirit flows in and through Jesus, and God flows in and through the Spirit, and Jesus flows in and through God. It's this constant motion. And in order to achieve this permeating, this dance of these members of the Trinity dancing with each other, there has to be some type of offering of oneself by each of these members. There's no forcing upon one another. And as we know, the best dancing that we can see here on Earth involves usually a lot of choreography. So usually there's someone leading and there's someone knowing how to follow that lead. But in each of these two people who are dancing, there is this giving of each other, right? You give one to the other. You have to be in tandem and giving each other the ability to do what you're supposed to be doing in this dance. And it's beautiful to watch. And perichoresis is sort of like that. There's this constant giving and this constant receiving of offering and accepting, of giving again and receiving again and again and again, this perpetual giving that results in a perpetual receiving. It's holiness in action, I think. So the giving of God from God to Jesus in this passage appears to me to be an extension of this concept of perichoresis. So of the giving of each person of the Trinity to the other two members of the Trinity. And that results in this amazing dance of interweaving and permeation. You kind of with me so far? A little bit? Yeah? Okay. So as it was told to me, creation is invited into this dance. And that is a lot of what this Rublev's icon illustrates. We are invited into this relationship of the Trinity. And as part of creation, humans, you and I, also join in this dance. And we are also interweaving and mutually permeating the dance of the Trinity. So we dance with God. That is part of what perichoresis is all about. But it's not just actually that we are only invited to dance with God. It's more than that. It's way more than that. And this text is kind of helping me see that. The Trinity was never about self-contained divine love. I've heard it said that God would be perfectly content to be in relationship with God's self without ever having to create, and I don't think that's true. I think instead that the Trinity is an outpouring of love. That's what causes the Trinity to have this coherence. Molly Marshall writes that perichoresis depicts a relationship of mutuality in which persons draw their identity from being related to others. And this relational mutuality forms the identity of God, of Jesus, and of the Holy Spirit. The relationship forms their identity. And part of this intrinsic relationship of this Trinity is to keep on moving outward in an ever-widening, ever-giving arc. Okay, so they continue to give. So all creation, all of this, the universe, everything, forms as a result of this perichoresis, because the energy that forms this Trinitarian center, this self-giving love, it keeps moving outward. It keeps moving outward. So what we discover, as Marshall says, is that humanity is necessary to the unfolding of the divine life. Creation had to happen because the Trinity, the Trinitarian God, had to move outward. It's this love that cannot be contained, and it's going to get bigger. God gives to Jesus, and Jesus gives to us. It is the pattern of perichoresis. Now, it's rare that I'm not in some form of angst. I'm an angsty person. And one of the common themes for me in my angstiness, even though I've had parents who have been steadfast and solid in their love for me, is anxiety over whether or not I'm lovable. It's a common one. It happens to be one that causes me angst. And when I was in my early 20s, in a particularly angsty time, I was on a spring break trip with a college ministry. And it was a significantly angsty phase, but I've had so many. And I was agonizing over this lovable theme, and I recall very clearly my astonishment when I realized quite suddenly, out of the blue, on my own, that I must be loved. If I was created by God, then it was only logical that I was loved, because God would not create something that God didn't like, right? God creates out of love, and thus I was loved. For if I was not loved, then I would not exist at all. For me, it was this staggering conclusion as this young 20-something. The force of this personal revelation continues today. What I had stumbled upon was this form of perichoresis. The creation of creation is necessary for the unfolding of the divine life, of the relationship of the Trinity with one another that inevitably necessarily moves outward. It's like the universe continues to expand, right? It continues to expand. And within the Judeo-Christian theology, it is the Trinitarian center of the universe that got everything going, and it keeps going. Right? It keeps. There's no end to it. And I kind of think when two people find each other, fall in love, and have kids, generally, hopefully, the creation of those kids is this expansion of love, right? It is a love relationship, hopefully and ideally, which creates this offspring that continues to make this love grow. Love wants to get bigger. It wants to go outward. So that is what strikes me about the giving that happens in this passage. It points to this larger reality, this giving essence of the whole Trinity, which is not just handed to us. This isn't just given to us. It literally forms us. It forms us. And this, it seems to me, is where we come to in regard with our relationship with the world. Okay, so we're talking about the giving and Jesus' relationship with God that affects us. And this affects our relationship with the world. So the text also speaks of the world almost as much as it does of the giving, but in many ways it's a lot more confusing. We've got Jesus talking about his own relationship with the world, and Jesus talks about his disciples' relationship with the world, and a lot of it seems contradictory. So Jesus says that his work is complete, that he is no longer in this world, verse 11, but two verses later he states, I say these things while I am still in the world. So what is it? In or out of the world? Jesus, please make up your mind. Are you in the world or are you out of the world? But what if there isn't really a clear decision to make here? What if this is really a shifting back and forth between the future and the present? Maybe there isn't a strong line of demarcation between this being in the world and being out of the world. And maybe there's just not a strong line of demarcation at all between this. And this certainly happens a lot toward the end of life for many. For many people, just ask a hospital chaplain for some stories about being in this world and then kind of being already in the other world. There's a lot of stories of folks who have really interesting experiences when they're nearing death about being here but also already being somewhere else. When Jesus speaks of the disciples' relationship with the world, he's not any clearer with them as he was with himself. He says, I'm not here, I am here. Mark Vitalis Hoffman sums up, the disciples were chosen from the world, verse 6. They are in the world, verse 11. They are hated by the world, in verse 14. They are not of the world, verses 14 and 16. And Jesus prays that the disciples be protected from the evil one who is at work in the world, but that they be taken out of the world, verse 15. It's a lot of bouncing around. So the disciples are also in and not in, supposed to be in, not supposed to be in. So could it mean that, like Jesus in this prayer, that we are both in and out of this world, maybe at the same time? That we are here physically, and yet this is not our only home, not our permanent mode of existence. So in this passage, the end of Jesus' short 33 years is looming. Okay, he's just about to be arrested. And for him, there's this blurring of lines of the existence between pre-death and post-death. He's on that. And this blurring of lines is a marker for a greater reality to which we just don't pay much attention to unless we're towards the end of life, usually. We might be physically present in this pre-death world, this world that we can see and that we can touch and we can hear and taste. But in the larger realm of things, it's like one leg of us is simultaneously inhabiting this pre-death world, and one leg of us is already in an existence that is eternal. So maybe it's not this choice, are you either in the world or are you not in the world? So I'm going to go over the first two bullet points real quick here. The giving that happens between the Trinity is the same giving that has made us and in which we find ourselves. That's the first point. That's the perichoresis. And the second point is that Jesus isn't exactly in existence, only in one existence at a time. He's both dwelling in the present and he's dwelling in the eternal future. So in regard to our relationship with the world, that's our reality too. We are both here in this physical reality on earth as we know it, and like the Trinity in which we exist by the way of perichoresis, we are also existing in an eternal timeline. So if your mind isn't blown yet, so I know mine is. This is big stuff. So I want to get to the third point, the last three verses. As amazing as these two bullet points are, and they can be a wonderful sermon, there is actually more, just like a cheesy infomercial. There's more. These two aspects of our reality stand on their own as life-affecting truths. They let us know that we are valuable beyond comprehension. Beyond comprehension. Being part of this perichoretic dance, the mutual permeating of the Trinity, of living partly in the eternal existence of the Trinity, that gives inestimable worth and value to each person and to every form of life in this entire universe. And there's more. There's still more. We get to these last three verses and we read, starting with verse 17. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you have sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself so that they also may be sanctified in truth. So Jesus is sanctified, and Jesus requests the same for the disciples, that they be sanctified. And the meaning of this word sanctification could have a whole sermon series attached to it. But for here, for the sake of not going longer than I already have, we can just call it becoming holy. Okay? Becoming holy. The sanctification of Jesus is being passed down to the disciples. But it's not just to feel good about the sanctification or to agonize about, like, oh my gosh, am I holy enough? There's an end game to this sanctification. There's an end game to it. The structure of these verses is verse 17, sanctify them. Verse 18, as you have sent me into the world, so I send them. And verse 19 is back to sanctification. So sanctify, go into the world, and sanctify. This is a nice sandwich here. Sanctify sandwiches this, as I have been sent into the world, so I send them into the world. Okay, so it's sandwiched by sanctification. Mark Vitalis tells us that sanctification is not a way of being made pure and holy by being set apart. It is intended as the way for the disciples to be sent forth to share the truth and the word. It is not a way of being taken out of the world, but being sent into it. Okay? So our sanctification is a way of being sent into the world. So to kind of try and tie this up even more, Roger Whitaker writes, as the disciples share in God's glory, which comes a couple of verses later in verse 22, as the disciples share in God's glory, so here the sanctification means being drawn into the truth, into the unity between God and Son, so that the holiness of God permeates them. Okay? They share in the very life of God, in the Son of God, through the Spirit of God, and thus they do the work of God as Jesus has done, revealing God's love and life and light. In other words, he continues, the amazing transcendent love evident between God and the Son is not an exclusive glory that humans must be content only to admire from afar. The love that God has for Jesus is the same love that God has for believers, and indeed for the whole world, for God is love, and there is only one love of God. So our sanctification is this very love of God existing and moving into the world. Okay? So, friends up here in Vancouver, as I mentioned in the beginning, a lot of people have written a lot of things about this text, this prayer in John 17. And this is, my thoughts are just one addition, and it's one that tends to kind of defy my comprehension a lot of times. Like, I can only think about this for a little while, and then it just gets too big for me to dwell there very long. But we exist in the love of God. We are made from the love of God, and we embody the love of God in the world. It seems like all sermons ought to be saying this anyway, in some way. And it is kind of like there's really only one sermon in the world, and we simply get to riff on it at one time, right? Just one piece of it. But this is like all of it, like one message is like all right here. Jesus happened to squish it all in this prayer of his. And I'm going to pray that the Spirit allows us to linger in this, in these truths, just a while. Just like when I was in my early 20s and I stumbled on the realization that I was loved simply because I existed, may we somehow hold and smell and ingest the majesty of our belovedness and of our purpose in the world. So envision yourself in this dance of the Trinity and dance to your heart's delight, your absolute heart's delight. Dance like the world depends on it, because it actually does. Amen.